Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, today joined by Makone Maja. Today we're going to be discussing ANC disciplinary proceedings against two of its high-profile members. We're also going to be talking about a road in the Eastern Cape town of Middelburg on the edge of the Karoo, and we're going to be talking about taxi associations and mafias. So let's get started off. The ANC has announced that it will be taking necessary steps to correct the behavior of its senior members, Malusi Gigaba and Senzo Mchunu. Now you may think, oh my goodness, this is such a wonderful turn of news. The suspended police minister is obviously getting in trouble because investigations into him have found out that he's been part of misconduct, and that's why he's being disciplined. And Malusi Gigaba was tied very closely to state capture, and he has 100 other scandals. That must be why they're disciplining them. But of course, that's not the reason. poor naive fools who would believe such a thing. As it turns out, they are in fact being disciplined because they made disparaging remarks about the ANC and its current direction. Senzo Mchunu, while speaking at the unveiling of a tombstone, said that the ANC was on the brink of collapse. He said, if we do not win municipalities in the upcoming local government next year, come the national government elections, we will be history. He said the ANC was like a person walking on the edge of a cliff and that the party needs to regroup before it's too late. He said, we know that people still love the ANC. We became big-headed and started taking them for granted, and they punished us. He said he still believed the party had time to mend its ways and get itself back on the right track. Malusi Gigaba at the same time went on a podcast where he said many things, but the things that he's been getting in trouble with the ANC for are criticizing the government of national unity, particularly when he said that they should not have gone into coalition with the DA. The statement put out by the ANC reads, the African National Congress has noted with serious concern and disapproval the recent conduct and public statements made by Comrade Malusi Gigaba and Comrade Senzo Mchunu. Their conduct represents a flagrant violation of ANC internal communication protocols and undermines the fundamental discipline of the movement. These comrades acted outside of any sanctioned organizational mandate or collective structure, making pronouncements that amount to deliberate de-campaigning of the ANC. These remarks do not reflect the view of any legitimate structure of the movement and must be seen as an opportunistic assault on the collective image, credibility, and cohesion of the African National Congress. These comrades are casting aspersions on the character and unity of the ANC, portraying the organization as divided, incoherent, and collapsing. These actions only serve the strategic agenda of counter-revolution and weaken the people's confidence in their movement. No disciplined comrade would, out of their own volition, make statements that embolden forces that have long sought to reverse the gains of our revolution. So it's not exactly clear what sanction will be leveled against them or how serious it might be. But Makone, you, when you read this story, you had one reaction, and it was kind of disbelief and outrage at the sheer gall of this. Would you like to explain why?
I mean, it seems as of late, the ANC is finding its critics, particularly those who emerge from the organization itself. It seems to blame them for the collapse of the image of the ANC. And I think, you know, that's clearly scapegoating. I am also appalled that Gigaba, who is now a member of the National Assembly, but also has his fingerprints all over the issue of state capture, that he's being punished for making, I mean, they were damning statements. I found that he said a lot more about the ANC and than what the article gives away. You know, it talks about the DA and its participation in the GNU and how Gigaba spoke out against that. But he was asked pointedly by the interviewer if he agrees with the general idea that the ANC's collapse began at the 2007 Bulawayo conference, and he, without missing a beat, says it did. He recalls statements and warnings that he was issuing all the way back in 2000, where he says he was warning about the levels of youth unemployment and that he was flagging them, not just in the organization, the ANC Youth League, the ANC mother body, and in government, but also in the government, yes, and that he was concerned about patronage He was worried that the youth were being kept on general subsistence and that that maintained them and maintained a loyalty, an unwarranted loyalty to specific ANC leaders, and that this general subsistence was just keeping them beholden to the organization rather than providing them with genuine empowerment where they'd be able to, you know, buy a house or support their families, but to be lectured about, or even to hear Gigaba describe patronage when, you know, he's the guy who facilitated early naturalization of the Gupta family. He was also, according, this is according to the state capture report and some of the findings that the public that were revealed when he was taken to the public protector. But also that he tried to arrange, I believe it's, I stand to be corrected, but I believe it's the Oppenheimers who have a private terminal at OR Tambo named Fireblade, and Gigaba tried to liaise with them to have the Guptas land their plane there instead of at the Waterkloof Air Base. He was reportedly, I think these are Outer's findings, that he had visited Saxon World over 20 times. He admitted that, but he said not once for business purposes, but his wife, who also testified in state capture, said there were cash exchanges made there and that they helped fund their wedding, which cost between 4 and 5 million rands. She was given cash worth 4 to 5 million rand by Gigaba, who allegedly received it from the Guptas to pay for their wedding. I mean, this is who we're talking about, right? And he's only getting punished for making some, I mean, truthful statements about the ANC. And I have to agree with Mahlengi here, the spokesperson of the ANC, Mahlengi Bengu, who is now famous from that interview she did on the State of the Nation podcast, where she said investors can go to India and Indonesia. But she says that, you know, it's anti-revolutionary. Of course, it's anti-revolutionary to be honest and to tell the truth, because the revolution is supported by tall tales and fairy tales and witches. So that was the source of my outrage, is that, you know, Mchunu and Gigaba are both accused of different of participating in different eras of state capture, but that the punishment only comes from them making disparaging comments about the ANC,
Yes.
which are obvious for, like, even blind men can see that the ANC is on its way out.
Yeah, no, this is the problem. I think the party continues to be unable to sort of look. On one hand, I do kind of understand it from a party discipline point of view, which is that you can't have, you know, high-ranking members of your party going around and trashing it in public. On the other hand, it is just ridiculous. These are criticisms that the party kind of basically almost admits are sort of true in some ways. You know, they wouldn't have to, you wouldn't have to have a party renewal plan and renewal strategy. And you wouldn't be having to, you know, talk about how you're going to deal with strategic setbacks all the time if their criticism didn't have at least something in it, if their description of the state of affairs was not at least sort of accurate. And it just seems kind of, you know, emblematic of where the party is that it's sort of, it's paranoid and it's defensive and it's just kind of lashing out. A lot of other parties might, you know, maybe they might let this slide, or maybe they would ask the person to withdraw their comments behind the scenes with pressure or something like that before trying to do the disciplinary route. But putting out a thing saying that they were advancing counter-revolutionary agenda, it's just, it's like.
Now that you
Right.
mention it, Nick, is Mchunu not just repeating the things that Fikile Mbalula has been saying, that, you know, they've been humbled, that they were big-headed, that they were not listening, they were not attentive to the concerns of their voters? So you're absolutely right to point that out, and also to demonstrate that this is performative discipline, that in the absence of substantive, genuine pursuit of, you know, taking action against people who basically corrupt this country and played a big role in the collapse of state-owned entities, somebody like Gigaba certainly up there in this, in the state capture echelons, that they have to, you know, act out when such minor offenses are committed, rather than taking on the ones that will actually demonstrate the commitment to party renewal, to reform, to addressing corruption.
Yeah, one wonders how much of this kind of fighting is being driven by a particular internal ANC faction that is just trying to eliminate these two for whatever reason. They're part of a different faction, or they just see the opportunity or something and get them out of the party. You know, who knows where this will go, but it is just another sign, like our story yesterday, of the ANC just being in this sort of huge amount of trouble and not really seeming to have any coherent plan to get out of it. Okay, let's move on to the Karoo town of Middelburg. This is not the Middelburg in Mpumalanga. Just to be clear, this is in the Eastern Cape. On the actually can't remember exactly where it is, but it's on the bit of the Karoo that's in the Eastern Cape. The local government had a 75 million rand project to build an integrated traffic control center with a weighbridge at an intersection where Mankey Street, which is like the main street into the town, links with the N9. They hoped the idea of this project was to control heavy freight trucks traveling through the town and just sort of manage the traffic better. And so the road was closed about a year ago to dig it up and start putting this thing in. And then it didn't really go further than that. The road remained closed after having been dug up. And it turned out that there was a dispute emerging between the transport department and the local municipality. This was back in May of 2024. This immediately began to affect business in the town. A lot of the smaller businesses in the town relied on tourists passing through, buying petrol, occasionally stopping for food, buying some things at the shops there. So they were all hurt by it because a lot of tourists were just simply going round the town rather than dealing with the long detour that they would have to make to get into it. The road had sort of periods of it looked like something was being worked on it. It might be open for a little bit, but it would be closed very shortly afterwards. The local community got a DA member of the provincial legislature, Heinrich Müller, to write letters asking for updates on the project. His most recent query, as of June of this year, has not even received a response. What remains of the project is a dilapidated construction site. The local ward councillor was kept trying to put pressure on the government, but didn't seem to get anywhere, was mostly just ignored. At one point, some wind farm contractors tried to open a section of the road, but a bucky ended up in a deep trench on the side of the road, and that basically ended that attempt to open it. And eventually, some local farmers got irritated, and they said, we're going to do it ourselves. So they did. They went and they flattened the road and they managed to get it open using bits of equipment and some of the staff from their farms to help them. Now, since that's happened, the municipality has provided, something to keep the gravel wet and also a grader to keep it sort of manageable. But the contract for that, according to the local ward councillor, is only set to run for a week. So it looks like the road might end up deteriorating and closing again. In other words, the community might have to come out and try and fix it again themselves. The transport department spokesperson, when asked for comment on this, said the farmers' actions to open the road were, quote, not ideal, but the department understood their frustrations. The way the community went about reopening the road was not quite the correct standard, and as things stand now, the department could be liable for any incidents on that road, but we have teams on the ground this week with the graders to tie up loose ends and make the road drivable again. Yes, that's not mentioning the fact, however, that the contract to do those things appears to be expiring soon. McCorne, interesting sort of story this. I think it's one that many South Africans across rural South Africa familiar with, of having to basically run government themselves. What's your take on this one?
The story is also a really good case study about how growth is stalled in the country, right? In the sense that when infrastructure is not in its best shape, or is not, infrastructure projects aren't being completed, despite the fact that millions of rand, 75 million, has been earmarked for the construction of this road, how that affects local businesses who obviously are then not able to employ more people or even grow their businesses. And as you read through that story, one of the great things that journalists did is to approach the local petrol filling station, to approach the hotel there and the bars surrounding or around where that road cuts, is to ask them how the lack of access to that road has affected their businesses. And each and every one of them is saying that there's been a decline in sales, been a decline in people who are filling their stations, their people are just making use of alternative routes. And that when that road was, when the farmers took matters into their own hands and that road was intermittently open, sales were on the rise again, but then they've suffered since the municipality shut down that road once more. So it's such a good case study in demonstrating how the government can impede growth and take some of those own goals. Because if this road was fully functional, if it was completed timeously as it was supposed to, if that money was being made to good use to actually build that road, then you'd have a lot more trucking companies being able to enter that community. To you'd have a lot more businesses having access to supplies, materials that they'd receive through these trucks, or just that trucks would pass there on their way elsewhere. Because what I've also read in that story is that Middelburg is where, like, a rest stop for like various tourists and also just trucking companies, but that they're not able to take those rests there anymore. And so they've lost a lot of patrons who would frequent that road, frequent the community, the nearby community businesses. And so it's literally taken money and incomes out of people's hands. It's such a devastating and a story that we're all familiar with. You know, the Eastern Cape and Limpopo, where I'm from, have so many similarities, because we had a similar incident in Limpopo where there was a ring road on the N1 that was supposed to connect us to various other roads. It would be like a central place of like splitting roads that go in different directions, different towns. And that project got stalled for years because of corruption, because the tenderpreneur took the money and ran. And so you just had this cut in the middle of the road where, you know, it no longer travels because the project was literally incomplete. It was such a visual demonstration of what incompletion looks like. It's like that bridge in Cape Town that's just hanging off, you know, the one that I'm talking about, right? Yeah. It's such a visual demonstration of the tender system, one, incomplete infrastructure projects, two. So it's really unfortunate. And I have all the empathy for the farmers and the local businesses that are quite panicked by the lack of progress on this road.
I think it's also quite interesting how it shows the sort of the way that our democracy is losing sort of credibility with people, which is that you actually had opposition politicians sort of taking up this issue, and they were mostly, it seems, just ignored by officials or told, no, it's coming. At one point, when the farmers said that they were going to go and grade the road, the ward councillor said, no, don't do it, because they've told me the situation is quite fluid and that, you know, this actually could all come right, and then maybe the municipality is going to get you in trouble if you actually do this. And then that came to nothing. So the farmer just went and did it anyway. And I think this is a one of the crises in our government, is that officials, quite frankly, just aren't responsive enough to public reps or to public pressure. And there are a variety of reasons for that. One of them is cadre deployment, which means that if you aren't from the ANC, many officials really don't care what you have to say. And even if you are from the ANC, they'll say, are you making the party look bad? Don't complain. But I think also part of this is just this sort of fear, that this kind of belief that, you know, there's no political competition here. There's no real accountability. We could do what we like. We can get away with it. No one's going to charge us with corruption. No one's going to fire us, et cetera, et cetera. We can get away with it. And I think that when people kind of interact with their public reps and then they don't get anywhere, even if it's not necessarily the public rep's fault, they feel alienated from the whole system. They're like, well, what's the point of having public reps?
Absolutely agree. I think people underestimate how hard it is to influence governments. And when you're describing, you know, the opposition parties that tried to intervene in this incident, and that it's over 9 months, I think, since they've sent letters to the municipality and have not been answered. I think the DA's presence in the GNU is also demonstrable of this. You know, I get confronted sometimes by people who say, you know, the IR is visible everywhere except like in meaningful ways, like making parliamentary submissions. I'm like, are you kidding me? The IR has been making parliamentary submissions since time immemorial. You just get ignored. So it really is hard to influence governments, and even when you're inside it, like GNU part, other GNU parties as well. It's incredibly difficult, but that is definitely what's contributing to the general sense of disenfranchisement, even in 30 years democratic South Africa.
Yeah. All right, last story. I'm only including this one because it boiled my blood. In KZN, around Ladysmith, the what is described in the media, and it's kind of terrifying that they describe it this way, but I think it's probably accurate. The feared Klip River Taxi Association has sent a letter. They describe themselves as the Klip River Scholar Transport Office. They wrote a letter to a number of schools in the Ladysmith area in KZN saying teachers must not give lifts to pupils and threaten to impound any cars that transported kids to school that weren't members of the taxi association. The letter read as this is translated from Zulu: as the Klip River Scholar Transport Office, we are asking that you please pass the message to the teachers who continue to give lifts to learners to stop that. There are transportation vehicles available to transport learners to school. A person seen doing this would have their vehicle impounded. Complete lawlessness, complete thuggery, complete sort of mafia takeover and overreach. And all we got from government in response to this was a sort of fairly meek comment from the provincial transport department spokesperson saying that this action would be illegal to impound people's vehicles as a private citizen. Well, yeah, obviously. What are you going to do about it? Your take, McCorney.
Jenna, I've been a public supporter of taxis on this show. They carry, last statistics I checked, over 60% of South African households. They are very vital to our economy. But the violence and the threat of violence is absolutely unacceptable. It's repugnant that a taxi association can say to a teacher, and I've been a beneficiary of the taxi school programs. I went to high school and I used a taxi my whole life, same as in primary school. We call it transport, but but it has a different connotation when you say it and you add vinegar and you say transport. And I cannot imagine that on one of those days when my transport didn't show up and they weren't able to communicate, that a teacher would give me a lift and would probably face violence, encounter violence at the hands of the taxis. Because it happens. Sometimes you wait for them after school for hours on end. And most of the time they will show up, even if they've encountered problems. But that a good, willing, meaning teacher would intervene and suddenly, be on the receiving end of violence from taxi drivers. It's absurd. But again, we've allowed the lawlessness. The taxis were the first mafias of anything. They were before the construction mafia. They were before all these emerging mafias over the last 10 years. And we sort of preserved that space where they operate in a parallel legal system, where they can get away with so much and they are untouched, both because of their significance and importance to the economy, but also because we fear the violence and we've allowed it to get out of control. And the police obviously fear taxi drivers. So yeah, it's absolutely unacceptable. And I hope to see that the KZN commissioner, who apparently took a meeting with them, Lieutenant Mkwanazi took a meeting with them. It's reported in the article. I think it said either last year or earlier this year that he takes the matter on before it results in the sort of violence we saw when the city of Cape Town did the same, which actually resulted in the death of a teacher and a tourist. I always mention those two, but it's quite, yeah. In light of the violence that's happening at Maponya Mall, when Uber driver was also, killed by a taxi driver, that they're so brazen that they can make those statements whilst there's so much scrutiny on them in the country at the moment. That just shows you the fearlessness and just the level of disregard for the laws of this country, that whilst all eyes are on the taxi association right now, they're still emboldened to come and threaten us with more violence. And this time violence against teachers and pupils, which, by the way, are indistinguishable. If you're in a car with a teacher and somebody shoots at you,
yeah,
you could also be a victim. So it's
if you try to protect your teacher when people are dragging them out to beat them with sticks or something, it's also going to be, you can imagine the horror. just outrageous, disgusting stuff. And these are crimes that, you know, you don't need any new laws, you don't need harsher punishments, you don't need this or that. You just need to enforce the laws that already exist. This is intimidation. This is threats. This is interfering with people's right to, you know, drive people around. Kind of outrageous stuff. Anyway, thank you very much for watching. We hope you found the show interesting. We'll be back tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.